May it please the court, my name is Kylie Dunn and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Herbert Alexander. I'd like to focus on the second and third issues in my opening brief. Under our Constitution, a defendant is entitled to test through cross-examination the reliability of any witness's statement, the truth of which is used to convict him of a crime. Here, the prosecution presented evidence that pictures of someone robbing a bank. These pictures were released to the public, and some anonymous person called in and accused Mr. Alexander of being the person in those pictures. The only issue in this case was ID. This evidence was probative of ID, and in fact, the prosecutor used this evidence in closing to argue that Mr. Alexander was guilty. We also have reason to believe that the jury used this evidence for its truth in making their determination. However, the defense did not get to test the reliability of this evidence of ID through cross-examination. We did not get to ask this anonymous accuser, for example, how well did he or she know Mr. Alexander, or what bias this person or motive this person might have had to accuse Mr. Alexander of this crime. The outcome of this issue really turns on whether this anonymous accusation was admitted for its truth or not.
Ms. Dunn,
yes.
On that question, I know that on page 15 of your opening brief, in discussion of the first issue about sufficiency, you state that this evidence was not admitted for its truth. So isn't that the end of your confrontation clause analysis?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. That statement was made in the context of arguing that the evidence presented at trial was insufficient as a matter of law to prove Mr. Alexander's identity.
But whether it's admitted for its truth or not remains the same regardless of what argument you're relating it to today.
Well, I don't believe that it was properly admitted for a non-truth purpose. I made that statement in the context of arguing that as it was supposedly admitted at trial, it was not admitted for its truth. I don't think that the prosecution can sort of have its cake and eat it too. If it was admitted for its truth, then there's a testimonial hearsay, and we should have had a chance to confront the anonymous accuser. If it wasn't, then, which is what the prosecutor's position was at trial, then the evidence was insufficient to prove identity.
So which do you think is true? Was it admitted for its truth or not?
I don't think it was admitted. I mean, I do think it was admitted for its truth. I think the prosecutor tried to admit it for another purpose, but then in fact, it was admitted for its truth. I think that when trying to decide whether something was admitted for its truth, you have to look at the stated non-hearsay purpose for which it was admitted. Evidence has a valid non-truth purpose only if that non-truth purpose goes to a material fact. So here, it wasn't admitted for any material fact. Supposedly, it was admitted to show what Detective Anderson did next, to sort of establish the timeline of the investigation. There's no relevant reason why the prosecution had to prove the timeline of the investigation. It's simply not a fact, it's a consequence of the determination of this action, which is the test for relevancy.
Well, Ms. Dunn, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes.
I have a portion of the record in front of me. The testimony from the, I believe it was the detective, said, based on that tip, I contacted deputies down at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, specifically Deputy Gomez, and asked him if they had an individual identified as a Herbert Alexander who was currently in a work release, and asked if there was further identifying. And then he went on to say why he pursued that line of investigation. Is that correct? That's in the record.
Yes, I do believe that. That is what Detective Anderson said. I don't think there was any need, though. It still remains not relevant to the jury's determination of whether or not Mr. Alexander was the robber in this case. There's no reason why they had to understand the exact steps that Detective Anderson took in his investigation.
But that would be an effect on listener idea, right? And that was a position that the people argued, I think, in
right.
the brief.
I think that's true. It's still, for it to be not admitted for its truth, though, it has to be admitted for some relevant purpose. And there's no relevance to the steps that Detective Anderson took. I think that that's, you sort of hit upon why this case is so distinguishable from People versus Robinson, which the state has relied on so heavily. In Robinson, the statements at issue were part of the story of the crime itself. They weren't, as they are here, just the story of the investigation. I think the facts of Robinson, and furthermore, the statements there didn't go to the only contested issue in the case. The facts of Robinson are important, I think. It was a police informant who, at the police's request, set up a buy of cocaine at a certain location. When he and the police went to that location, he identified the defendant as being one of his suppliers. I think it would have been nearly impossible to tell the story of what happened in Robinson without including those informant statements, and so therefore, arguably those statements were relevant and needed to tell the jury what happened in Robinson. That's just not the case here. There was no need for the jury to have this evidence to understand what happened. And I think it's also important to note, when Detective Anderson, when Deputy Gomez testified about what happened as a result of the call from Detective Anderson, he didn't need the tip to tell that little portion of the story. Nor was the tip necessary to explain the photo lineup. In fact, Detective Anderson explained the photo lineup and that he presented that to witnesses, I believe it was on page 100 of that June 30th transcript. And that was before he got into this anonymous tip evidence.
Is it your theory that the logic path of the investigation could have been explained to the jury just based on the fingerprint evidence without any reference to the tip?
I think that to the extent it was in any way necessary to explain to the jury the path of the investigation, it could have been done in another way, either with the fingerprint evidence. There's some treatises on this subject that suggest things like based on information received. I'm not saying that's a great way either, but it's better than what happened here.
But Ms. Dunn, it seems to me your arguments sound like a 401 or 403 argument, which I know you also make
yes.
in your brief, but I'm not sure how any of that has to do with whether it's hearsay.
Okay. Well, first of all, I did make a 401 and 403 argument in the brief, and I think that this court could certainly reverse based on a 401 and 403 analysis. The evidence wasn't relevant, and to the extent it was overly prejudicial. I think the argument that I'm trying to make here is that we can't just accept the prosecutor's purported reason for introducing this evidence at face value, which is essentially, I think, what you would have to do in order to say that this evidence was not testimonial, was not hearsay in this case. You would have to accept that because the prosecutor said it wasn't. And I don't think that that can happen here because, under the facts of this case. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
And I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
May it please the court, William Kozlowski, registration number 37824 on behalf of the people. I'd like to start with the content of this tip evidence. Throughout the defendant's brief from here today, she stated that the tip accused the defendant of being the perpetrator of the crime. That's not what the evidence was. The detective testified that he was relayed information that someone called in a tip who said the person in the video looks like the defendant. there was no positive identification that was related to him. So just wanted to clarify that. And secondly, whether the evidence was admitted for its truth or not, as Judge Navarro observed, in her brief, she stated that it wasn't, and the reason that's the case is that was the basis for the trial court's ruling. The trial court said this is admissible because it's not being offered for its truth. Here, the evidence was not offered to it for its truth, and it was offered for a relevant purpose, specifically to explain Detective Anderson's investigation.
But at that time, didn't he already have the fingerprint match, so he could have explained?
No, not at all. The sequence of events is the robbery occurs, I think 3 days go by, the tip is received, then Detective Anderson calls the jail, figures out that the defendant was out on work release during the time of the robbery. He puts together the photo lineup, shows it to the witnesses. The witnesses are unable to identify the defendant. And then he testifies that the case went stagnant for at least a month. And then independently, the fingerprints are matched. And then it's at that point that they issue an arrest warrant for the robbery. So I think it's even admissible just for that to show that the fingerprint evidence occurred after and completely independent of the lineup, and to show the biggest issue, why it's relevant to show why the defendant was in the lineup. Otherwise, his name just magically appears.
Okay, thank you.
As the Silva case cited in the brief states, if a jury would not otherwise understand why an investigation targeted a particular defendant, then evidence such as this is relevant for a non-hearsay purpose. And as to, I think you only have to look to what the basis for the trial court's ruling is. The court's ruling is this is admissible, not for its truth. Now, if the prosecutor makes statements to the effect relying on its truth, which we don't think happened here, but if that does happen, that's a separate claim that the defendant needs to bring. Just as if you bring in 404B evidence and it's relevant to identity or something like that, and no one has a problem with that, and then in closing argument, the prosecutor says, oh, and by the way, this shows he's an awful person and you should convict it for that reason. That doesn't render the trial court's initial ruling incorrect. That's a separate claim of error that needs to be brought. So anything that the jury did or the prosecutor did later on doesn't render the initial evidentiary ruling incorrect. And that's Robinson states that. And in this case, the defendant didn't object under 401 or 403, so that's reviewed for plain error. And it was particularly relevant to explaining the sequence of events and why the defendant was in the lineup. And in addition, the defendant says that the timing of all this doesn't matter. The timing of it actually matters to help his case, because a big part of his case was that the two tellers were unable to identify him. And so, to help his case, the jury needs to know that those tellers were shown the lineup 3 days after the robbery. So I think it's very relevant even for his case as to why the sequence of events and why the detective took the actions he did and when he took those actions.
Mr. Kozolowski?
Sure.
Did the defense ever ask for a limiting instruction with respect to the hearsay purpose? For the non-hearsay purpose?
No. At one point, I think on the second day of trial, the defense attorney said something to the effect, I'm concerned this is coming in for its truth, but she never asked for a limiting instruction and never objected during closing argument to the supposed use of its truth.
Okay, thank you.
And that, in addition as to the 403 analysis, in the trial court's initial ruling, the court said, I'm going to admit this for this for its truth, or not for its truth. And prosecutor, you need to target your questions to keep it within those bounds. And the prosecutor essentially said, what happened with the tip? Detective Anderson said, you had a tip that said, the defendant, or this person looked like the defendant. And then the next question was, did you do anything based on that tip? There was no exploring the reliability or using it for its truth. And I agree with defense counsel that Robinson is important to this case, and it's our position that the facts in Robinson are much more prejudicial to the defendant, and but that evidence was nevertheless admissible. The evidence was that a detective contacted a CI. The CI said he could do a drug deal with these two people by this name. He set up the drug deal. He drove there with the cop. The cop said, are we going to do this? And the CI pointed out who the offender was. And so it was essentially the entire crime. This was a momentary thing, just explaining the investigation. So I think, even if it was a preserved 403 analysis, I think it would still be sustainable. The court has any further questions about other issues? We ask that you affirm the judgment. Thank you.
First of all, just to address the AG's point regarding the contents of the tip, I'd like to direct the court to page 103 of the June 30th transcript, which is when this evidence first came in. Prosecutor asked, was there a tip received in the course of this investigation concerning a probable suspect as far as this robbery? He said, yes, I did receive an anonymous tip. Question, can you tell the jury how that occurred? Answer, I was basically provided information that an anonymous tip had come in and had identified a potential suspect as Herbert Alexander. That's how this evidence event first came in. Then he described the contents as being that it looked like Mr. Alexander. However, I think that's a distinction without a difference. The AG on appeal and the prosecutor below have never said that this was not testimonial evidence. And indeed it was. They accused him of being involved in the crime. Secondly, the basis for the trial court's ruling does not end the analysis of whether this is testimonial hearsay. Whether it's testimonial hearsay is a question of law for this court's determination. Simply because the court said it was doesn't make it right. That's why we're here on appeal. Third, the sequence of events, you know, below and continuing on appeal, the other side has continually stated the sequence of events are relevant to the determination of Mr. Alexander's guilt. And this is simply not the case. I think it's important for this court to keep in mind that this is not a case where the defense in any way attacked the thoroughness of the investigation, in any way implied, like, how would you guys pinpoint Mr. Alexander? Those are the types of defense theories that might make this kind of evidence relevant, and that did not happen here. To the extent that somehow it helped us to have this evidence, I think that's a strategic question that the defense counsel at trial should have had the opportunity to make. We did not have that opportunity. It was rule admissible. I can't remember which judge, but one of you asked about whether or not, or pointed out that defense didn't ask for a limiting instruction. I think that, first of all, a limiting instruction doesn't cure the constitutional error that occurred here. So to the extent a limiting instruction would have done anything, I think that that analysis only comes in if you find it was not testimonial hearsay and that it was relevant, and that therefore there was prejudice that a limiting instruction maybe could have limited. I don't think you can find it wasn't testimonial hearsay. I don't think you can find that it was relevant. And I further think that limiting instruction under these circumstances would not have sufficiently addressed the situation. We have case law, Bruton versus U.S., the U.S. Supreme Court case, said under certain circumstances, a limiting instruction just can't deal with terribly prejudicial and unconstitutional evidence. You can't expect the jury to realistically ignore evidence that goes to the one thing they've been asked to figure out, which is whether or not Mr. Alexander committed this crime. You can't realistically ask them to ignore this evidence that goes to that fact. And I think in determining that this evidence was in fact hearsay and not properly admitted as non-hearsay, this court can look to the purported purpose for which the evidence was admitted and whether that was a valid, relevant purpose. And it can also look to the lack of evidence that, so the lack of evidence that was also admitted on that the truth purpose that it could have been admitted for. Didn't really say that very well, but the balance between this supposed probative value of the non-hearsay purpose and whether or not the evidence goes to the only contested element in the case. And when you look at the balance here, it's obvious that this fact here was actually offered for its truth. I don't think I have anything else. I do want to point the court to the references that the prosecutor made to this tip evidence in closing. There were three times that he mentioned it. Page 30 of the July 2nd transcript, page 33 of the July 2nd transcript, and page 56 of the July 2nd transcript.
Did defense counsel make any objection to that as improper argument?
No, Your Honor, but I don't think that it was necessary for us to object to admission the improper truth use of this evidence. We objected pre-trial and said we didn't want this evidence to come in, that it was testimonial hearsay, that it was being offered for its truth. I think that when, in fact, it was used for its truth at trial, both by the prosecutor and in the juror questions, it's simply that our argument was borne out. We were right. It was admitted for its truth based on how the prosecutor used it and how the jurors were engaging with this evidence. For these reasons, I ask the court to reverse Mr. Alexander's convictions. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.